It's early afternoon. Are you feeling tired? If you have a problem sleeping well and feel excessively tired during the day, you may suffer from sleep apnea. Apparently, millions of Americans do. Just what sleep apnea is and how it's to be treated is the subject of today's Please Explain. And joining us are Dr. David Rappaport, a pulmonologist, the director of the Sleep Medicine Program at the NYU School of Medicine, and Dr. Susan Redline, the associate director of the Clinical Sleep Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and a professor of sleep medicine at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we invite our listeners to join in on the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Dr. Rappaport, let's begin with you. What's the clinical definition of sleep apnea?
Well, sleep apnea is a condition which, as the name implies, manifests only during sleep. So it's a breathing problem, and what happens is that the throat is held open while we're awake and under normal circumstances and kept stiff so that we can breathe through it. If you think of a collapsible tube, if you tried to breathe through a rubber hose that was collapsing, you would suck it shut, and the muscles of the throat hold it open. When we go to sleep, normally, without any disease, those muscles relax, as do most muscles in the body, and the tube becomes floppy and collapsible, and so it is prone to collapse, but of course in most people it does not. The mildest form of collapse is just a vibration. We call it snoring. When that gets a little bit more excessive, and we don't know why, but it's quite common, the tube, the breathing passages, actually get sucked shut while you try to breathe as soon as you go to sleep, and that can be either partial or complete. Complete is called an apnea or a blockage of breathing. And, of course, that can't go on for very long because you're unable to get any air in, and so it wakes you up. And so after about 30 seconds of this, typically, you will wake up, the muscles will stiffen, the throat becomes rigid again, and you're able to breathe. And so as soon as you wake up, everything is made normal. You breathe for a few breaths, and then you fall back asleep. And in the worst form of this, this happens literally up to 2 times per minute, every 30 seconds. And so it can happen hundreds of, even several hundred times in a night, and, of course, disrupt your sleep. And the main symptoms people feel are the ones you described, which is that you feel very sleepy the next day because you've been woken up all these times. And the person listening to you has listened to this terrible choking, gasping sound all night long, and they've been kept up by that.
Now, Dr. Redline, the idea of waking 2 times a minute is hard to imagine. Are people with sleep apnea aware that it's happening?
And some aren't. Many individuals, the most common complaints are that sleep is disrupted and the person does not feel the restorative or refreshing qualities of sleep.
But they don't have insomnia, do they?
Well, insomnia is a condition where people perceive problems getting to sleep, maintaining sleep, or early morning awakenings. And many patients with sleep apnea will have many of those symptoms. However, in cases of sleep apnea, often those symptoms can be explained by the disruptions in breathing that they're experiencing that are waking them up. And once treated, that will resolve those awakenings.
Now, what are some of the main concerns with sleep apnea other than that you can feel very fatigued? Can this kind of sleep deprivation do any damage?
Oh, absolutely. First, let me say that just feeling fatigued itself is a red flag that the person may be excessively sleepy, prone to attentional lapses, and at risk for automobile crashes, work-related accidents, and overall, cognitive problems. But in addition to those neuropsychological and functional problems, we also are aware that sleep apnea, because it can pose great stress on the heart and other body systems and actually increase one's risk for developing high blood pressure, coronary artery disease, stroke, and diabetes, and other conditions.
Dr. Rappaport, aren't there a number of different types of sleep apnea? What's the most common?
Well, we've been a little sloppy so far in saying sleep apnea. Technically, what we've been talking about is obstructive sleep apnea, and that is the blockage of breathing.
That's the one with the heavy snoring.
That's the one with the heavy snoring, in most cases, not in all cases, but in almost all cases, and with the blockage as the underlying problem. But there is another form of apnea, sleep apnea, where the people actually stop breathing. The brain stops sending the signals to the pump to breathe, and that's called central apnea. And we generally see that much less in the sleep laboratories. Until recently, that was considered a relatively minor and unimportant thing. But there's now a recognition that this is very closely linked with a series of medical conditions, in particular heart failure and related issues. And this is called central sleep apnea. We don't quite know the significance of this in the same way as obstructive sleep apnea. We're not as good at treating it. And sometimes treating the underlying condition is all it takes. But the key is that it's very common and is a big problem being investigated, and there are suspicious links of central sleep apnea also to long-term consequences and acceleration of the heart problems that cause it, as opposed to obstructive apnea, where we think that causes the heart problems.
Dr. Redline, let's talk a bit about snoring again. First of all, if I hear somebody snoring, could I tell whether that's a result of apnea? For example, a lot of people make little snoring sounds throughout the night. Others can sound like a chainsaw. Is the chainsaw the problem? Is that indicative of a problem like sleep apnea?
Yes, it is. And I think it's important to recognize that snoring, as Dr. Rappaport indicated, is one of the first signs, so to speak, that the throat is collapsing at night or vibrating excessively. So you could actually think of snoring as, you know, in a continuum as maybe one of the earliest symptoms. However, as a person's risk for sleep apnea increases, not only will their throat vibrate, the muscles around their throat vibrate, but the throat will collapse, and that will prevent really breathing the normal flow of air in and out. You know, the throat will be collapsed. So one of the things that clearly loud snoring and irregular snoring may be evidence that you're not simply having vibration of the tissues, but in fact there is recurrent collapse. And typically that's goes beyond snoring and may also include gasping or snorting. However, having said that, I think it's important to note that often people are not very good at really quantifying and characterizing how the qualities of their snoring. And certainly snoring of any quality may be a sign of sleep apnea. But also, as you indicated, more frequent snoring, louder snoring, and snoring that's associated with snorting and gasping at night is of particular concern.
Is this a genetic condition? If your parents had it? Go ahead, Dr. Rappaport.
I'm sorry. I was going to say that one of the things that people should be aware of is that snoring as a term includes many different things. And the sort of steady noise that people call snoring is probably the lowest level of concern, although when it gets loud enough, it often lapses into these cycles. And what happens with full-blown apnea is that the snoring is the good part. The silence, which happens during the apnea, is the bad part. And so what happens typically is the people will have a silence for 30 seconds while they have the apnea, and when they wake up and start flailing around a little bit in the bed, they'll often make very loud snoring and gasping sounds. That pattern is unquestionably apnea and can be picked up by almost anybody who knows to look for it. The steady snoring is a little more tricky, and there it becomes the quality of the snoring and the frequency with which it happens and so on. And snoring is a very common condition. Over 50% of adults have some degree of snoring, and that may not be terribly bad, but it is a sign that you're headed in that direction. And when it gets loud enough or intermittent, then we're talking apnea.
Do we have any sense of what causes this? Can it be genetic? If one of your parents had it, are you more likely to have it? Or is this more likely associated with things like age, weight, heart disorders, smoking, alcohol?
Yeah. The answer is many of the above. Genetic factors, we and others have found, clearly are predisposing factor. Those individuals who have a family member with sleep apnea are more than twice as likely to have sleep apnea themselves. And what those genetic factors are probably include a number of factors that relate to sort of the structure of the nose and throat area, where fat is deposited, and how breathing control is regulated. But in addition to genetic factors, the biggest risk factors do include overweight, in particular weight that tends to center around the middle and around the neck.
Can losing weight make an immediate difference?
Losing weight in most people does improve sleep apnea, and even very modest weight loss can improve sleep apnea. But some patients, it's very important to note that there is a sizable minority of patients who are not overweight. So weight isn't the whole story, but certainly keeping your weight as optimal as possible is one really good strategy to help prevent sleep apnea or begin in addressing it as a management principle. As we grow older, unfortunately, sleep apnea prevalence does increase, and that may be due to a number of different factors that relate to, you know, how the airway is, the airway configuration, how the airway is controlled. Alcohol can depress the action of the muscles around the throat, and many of you will recognize if you drink some alcohol before you go to bed that night, you may be particularly loud in terms of snoring. So actually alcohol acutely may make your sleep apnea worse. And so there, and then the other thing is
smoking.
Nasal obstruction. So nasal obstruction too will you know, from allergies or irritants, can also exacerbate snoring and sleep apnea. Smoking is actually by itself not a specific risk factor for sleep apnea, although we know it's a risk factor for so many other problems.
Now, Dr. Rappaport, can changing your sleeping position help?
Yes, absolutely. And again, if I could build on what Susan's saying, this is a condition, and I think many people may not appreciate how common it is. 30 years ago, we thought this was a very, very rare, interesting, but very rare condition. We now are estimating that potentially somewhere between 10 and 20% of the adult population and a smaller number of children is affected by this. So we're talking about something extremely common. The more severe end of it is perhaps a little less frequent, but there's a lot of people affected by this, and there are many factors. It's not one thing like a bacteria that causes one disease. And position, your question, is one of them. So lying on your back clearly makes things worse in everybody. So if you don't snore and you roll onto your back, you may snore. Almost all wives know this about their husband and try to keep them off their backs.
Mm-hmm.
If you have apnea, the apnea may get much, much worse in not only your position, but certain parts of sleep. What's called REM sleep or dreaming sleep is also a period where you're particularly vulnerable and where those who have apnea have the worst apnea.
Now, you mentioned wives knowing this about their husbands. Is sleep apnea more common in men than women?
It is. Once again, there is an increase in the apnea in men by a factor of about 2 to 3-fold. But again, it's not exclusively. So there are a lot of women who have apnea also. We used to believe this was almost exclusively a male disease, and a lot of people have the stereotype that it's only overweight or obese middle-aged men. That's certainly the most common group, but there are large numbers of women. There are people who are not overweight, small changes in your jaw structure, the bony structure, and there's also probably a racial component. So certain groups are more prone to having the apnea at the same weight and for the same gender. And typically those are both the Asian groups, which are fairly well studied as having more apnea for not being overweight, and certainly among African Americans there appears to be an increased incidence, and that's actually work that Susan's done.
And we'll come back to that after we take a little break, and we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guests are Dr. David Rappaport, the director of the Sleep Medicine Program at NYU School of Medicine, and Dr. Susan Redline, the associate director of the Clinical Sleep Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, professor of sleep medicine at Harvard Medical School. The number again, 212-433-9692. And we are back with today's Please Explain Look at Sleep Apnea with Dr. Susan Redline, the associate director of the Clinical Sleep Program at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, professor of sleep medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. David Rappaport, a pulmonologist who's the director of the sleep medicine program at the NYU School of Medicine. We're getting a lot of calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692, and people are writing in at our show page at WNYC.org. Let's get to a few of these calls, starting with Alejandro from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Hi, Leonard. My question was, I've been suffering from sleep apnea for several years. I have a deviated septum and narrow throat passages, although after using the CPAP machine for several years and some major weight loss, I've been told it's become less severe, although it's still in the severe range. And I've also been told by others that my snoring is less severe, but I was wondering if there was a more permanent solution. My doctor has told me that surgery isn't worth the risk, so I was wondering what your thoughts were on surgery and if there was more of a cure.
Well, this is something which is very debated and is very specific. Surgery seems like it ought to work for mechanical problems. And so if your doctor can identify specific abnormalities in either the throat or the nose, it is sometimes worth considering repairing them. The surgery that is done when you don't find those, or in addition to correcting specific problems, which is sleep apnea surgery, has been around for a long time, and it's been very disappointing. It really only produces total cures in a fraction of the people, and that's...
Well, the caller has a deviated septum. Wouldn't the surgery work there?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's in the gray zone, and sometimes that helps, but more often than not, it merely improves things a little bit, makes the CPAP more tolerable. We haven't talked about CPAP, but that's a mask that's worn to treat the apnea by sort of applying a small pressure to the nose.
Alejandro, do you use CPAP?
Yes, I do. I've had one for several years, and my doctor attributes the use of the CPAP and the weight loss to it being less severe, but I'm still in the severe range. I think it's my number is around 50.
There are some other treatments other than surgery. None of them is a cure in the sense that you do it once and then, you know, it's over. There are some other devices other than CPAP which show some promise. Nothing works as well as CPAP if you tolerate it, and the problem, of course, is many people don't tolerate it. But if it works 100% in most cases. Unfortunately, the more permanent fixes like surgery and a variety of other devices have a less than complete success rate, but they are worth considering, especially if you've already improved in the other areas of losing weight and so on. And there may be a dental device which sometimes works for milder apnea. There may be some other devices out there. And we're all hoping for something coming down the pike, but that hasn't arrived yet, and there are many avenues of investigation. But this is a pretty new field. I mean, we've only had good recognition of this disease for about 20 or 30 years.
Now, CPAP stands for continuous airway pressure. It's kind of forcing your breathing.
Yeah. It doesn't actually force breathing. What it does is it maintains a very low level of pressure in the breathing passages. It's connected either through the nose or through the nose and mouth with a mask or some similar device, and it provides a very little bit of pressure. It's very similar to what you would have if you went up to the top of a tall building. Very small level of pressure, but it's just enough to make sure that the inside of the throat passages never go negative with respect to the outside, and so that collapse I talked about earlier never happens. And so as a result, you do the breathing. All it does is hold your airways open.
Now, Dr. Redline, when do you know if you should see a doctor? Is it when somebody says, I couldn't sleep because you were making so much noise last night?
Well, that's certainly one of the ways. Many of the patients who come to the lab come with exactly that complaint. They've been banished to the couch at night, or they're being threatened with divorce. However, more commonly, I think if you're assessing your own medical condition, the key is that you have a problem during the daytime. So typically, many people just can't stay awake, and they're very sleepy. And if you've gone through a list of easy explanations, such as I don't sleep at night because I work too hard or something else like that, or I travel a lot. If you're sleeping adequately, number of hours that is reasonable, say 6 or 8 hours a night, and you're still feeling terrible during the day, there's something wrong. And the most common thing, not the only thing, but the most common thing is apnea. If in addition to that, you fall into one of the high risk categories of being male, being overweight, being in your 40s or 50s or older, this makes it highly likely you have apnea. And finally, if someone is available to listen and tells you that you have the loud snoring we talked about, now the odds become very high. So to me, that's the reason you go in. But ultimately, you can only tell if you have sleep apnea if you have an evaluation of your sleep.
And Dr. Redline, I understand that the definitive way of diagnosing sleep apnea is by undergoing a sleep study or polysomnography. Can you tell us what that is and what the process is like?
Sure. There's been a lot of progress in the way we diagnose sleep apnea over the last number of years. And depending on any individual's level of complexity, they'll either be asked to come and spend the night in a sleep laboratory, or and in that environment, they'll have their brain waves measured by small electrodes that are placed on their scalp, and their breathing, and their heart rate, and their body position, and their snoring intensity, all will be measured over an entire night so that the physician can really get a good picture of how deep their sleep is, how disrupted it is, and what their breathing pattern is, how many times they stop breathing, and their levels of oxygen. However, at this point in time, there's also many very useful home-based sleep studies that are much simpler. And for those individuals who have fairly uncomplicated presentations, they may be studied at home. And that will vary according to their insurance and other factors. But many of these home studies are something that can be dropped off in one's home and involves putting a couple of simple sensors under the nose and around the chest and on the finger, and collect much of the similar information that's collected in the laboratory, with the exception that information on brain or sleep quality isn't measured, but the breathing information is collected.
Well, I've seen photos of people in these laboratory sleep studies, and they appear to be covered with wires. It's hard to believe that anyone could actually fall asleep under those conditions.
Well, I think pictures can be pretty deceptive. And in fact, good laboratories and good technicians are really very adept at keeping those senses as minimally obtrusive. And in fact, the ones on your head, I've worn them many times, you can barely feel. But it can be a little unusual, and it may take a little bit of adaptation. But in fact, a good hookup and a good technician, you should be able to sleep quite soundly. You should be able to roll over and curl up under the pillow without a problem.
John,
I think most of us in the field have worn these tests and know that from personal experience it's possible.
Now, John from Forest Hills, you have a question about CPAP?
Yeah, I was diagnosed. I took a sleep test and all that sort of stuff. I've had it for years. And I'm very tall, and I have a big body all over. And so we went through about 4 masks before there was one big enough for my face. And even then, it was still not big enough. So for the longest time, I just couldn't use it. It hurt too much. I want to make a point here. So recently, I got what are called nasal pillows, which are these things that stick in your nose, which is much better. But by the same token, long about 3 o'clock, my nose hurts so much that I rip it off. And I was just wondering. You know, when I was a kid, I'm 70 years old. When I was a kid, people talked about things called oxygen tents. Wouldn't it be possible to, instead of just these masks, which hurt as far as I'm concerned, to have some sort of thing that covers the, you know, from the shoulders up so that you don't have these things pressing on your face or on your nose? Because that's really why it's uncomfortable and why it's hard to use.
It's certainly theoretically possible, but remember that the purpose is to have some pressure that's delivered only to the inside, not the outside of your throat. So whatever you build would have to be limited probably not to your shoulders, but to some part of your face. And there are some versions of that have been tried. But your experience with masks is worth commenting on. I think that the key to this disease is to make the treatment acceptable, and we do whatever we can. There are a variety of variations on the connection principle, and you've gone through some of them. In the past, there were several people who were able to mold custom masks, which were actually quite comfortable. They did it with a kind of a dental acrylic that was molded to your face. A cast was made, and then we could mold the mask to it, and then you'd apply it, and that would solve the problem of the fact that you appear to have an unusual shape of your face and nose. So there are tricks like that, but your idea is worth pursuing, and if you're a person who does that kind of thing, you might want to try and jury-rig something and see if there's somebody who could make it into a usable device. But I would caution you, it has to stay pretty much on the head. It can't come down onto the neck without losing its theoretical effectiveness.
Now, we have a call from a doctor involved in all of this. Dr. Albarat Akhtar, is it?
Yes, correct.
And you work with the sleep apnea in children. I was going to ask about that because Dr. Ridline also does work with that.
As do we all.
Now, I'm throwing this out to Dr. Ridline as well. Are the causes of child sleep apnea different than in adults?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think in children, the most evident risk factor, or the most commonly recognized risk factors, usually large tonsils and adenoids.
So you have the tonsils taken out, and the problem is resolved.
I was going to say that will resolve the problem in the majority of children, but in fact there may be a minority of children, or maybe 20% of children or so, who may still have sleep apnea or may have recurrence of sleep apnea. And the more we study it, we realize that many of those children who are at risk for residual sleep apnea after they have their tonsils out often may have many of the same risk factors than adults have. And in fact, they even may come from families where parents and other siblings have sleep apnea, suggesting that there may be a genetic susceptibility that affects children and adults alike.
I want to bring Dr. Albarakhtar in here because we have very little time. What did you call about, doctor? You're at the you're a physician at Stony Brook University?
Yes, I just want to clarify one thing. I'm actually a sleep fellow at Stony Brook University. I'm doing my fellowship in sleep, and I did not want to impose on the great speakers that you have on the show. It's just, I was listening to your show while I'm driving, and I just wanted to point out that the symptoms in children is completely different than the symptoms in adults, because children don't usually present
heavy snoring,
decreased energy. They would present usually with behavioral problem, learning disabilities, attention deficit disorder, or anxiety, like OCD spectrum of disorders. And in some cases, you know, kids come to us because the mother noticed or the father noticed that the kid is snoring too much, or rarely having witnessed sleep apnea if the child is in an age not sleeping with his parents in the bed anymore. And we found that when we treat these underlying issues, which is relatively more simple to
very
treat
quickly,
kids,
sorry.
I'm sorry. Relatively very small, very easy to correct in kids with tonsillectomy sometimes if it's enlarged tonsils or stuff like that. That helps with the underlying anxiety issues. Also.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. There's so much more to talk about. My great thanks to our guest, Dr. Susan Ridline of the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and Harvard Medical School, and Dr. David Rappaport, Director of the Sleep Medicine Program at NYU School of Medicine. Thank you both so much.
I don't know
much.
If you have time for...
I have no time. We are out of time. On Monday's show, environmentalist Amy Larkin explains why we need to translate the costs of global warming and extreme weather into dollar amounts and start paying up. And then Chuck Klosterman on villains and what we're really saying when we say someone's bad or evil. Philip Caputo talks about what he learned while traveling the United States from its most southern point to its most northern point. And reporter Robert Kolker discusses the Long Island killer who used Craigslist to kill four women who used the site to advertise as escorts. He's still at large. The London Low Paid Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. And we had help today from Casey Dalrymple, Helen Rauner, and Keita Sood, and contributing producers Fran Jacobs and Bonnie LaFave. I'm Leonard Low Paid, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.